Really appreciate everyone being here. Got just about a house full tonight. That's great. Very encouraging to me to see people come out, people that I've known in the past, and they know me. Some of them know me very well, and they come anyway. And so that's really encouraging to me. I appreciate it a great deal. Appreciate those who have led us in our worship tonight, the good singing we've had, and the good selection of the songs, and good participation by everybody. It just makes for really encouraging and uplifting experience together. That's what we want worship to be, isn't it? I mean, we want it to be encouraging and uplifting and inspiring and exhilarating. And I just appreciate the effort everybody's put in tonight to make this hour of worship those things. Well, let's look at the book of Daniel tonight. We're going to take a passage from the book of Daniel tonight and talk about it a little bit. And I hope we'll be able to say some things and direct some things to our attention that might help us live a life that's pleasing to God, that might encourage us and inspire us to live a life that God is pleased with. As you know from previous Bible study, Daniel is an outstanding book in the Old Testament. It provides a great deal of information concerning the rise and fall of world empires. And so it opens up with Daniel being taken into captivity by the Babylonians. And then Daniel talks about the fall of the Babylonian Empire and the rising up of the Medo-Persian Empire. And then the Greeks come next, and then the Romans come next. And in Daniel chapter 2, he tells us that in the days of that fourth empire, the Roman Empire, the Lord is going to, and of course that's already happened, but he's going to establish a kingdom that will never be destroyed. And so that's quite significant. That's heavyweight material, isn't it? The rising and fall of world empires, and Daniel predicts that here in the biblical book of Daniel. It contains important background information for the New Testament. If you've ever studied the book of Revelation, which I imagine many of us have, if not all of us, most of us maybe, have at least studied it at some point, you know that the book of Daniel provides some keys to understanding some of the imagery there in the book of Revelation. It contains stories that have inspired people to do right now for over 2,500 years. And so Daniel lived, as we said a moment ago, I think, in the 6th century B.C. We're in the 21st century A.D. now, and people have been inspired by events and stories that we find in the book of Daniel for all that time. In fact, there are people who not really diligent Bible study, Bible students don't know very much about the Bible at all, and yet they know some of the stories in the book of Daniel. Maybe a little background information will help as we work our way up to the passage we want to talk about tonight. Well, the people of Judah have not been serving God faithfully. They've been unfaithful to Him and immoral, going after idols led by kings that led them into idolatry and infidelity. And so God brings the Babylonians against Judah, and led by Nebuchadnezzar, they come into Judah and conquer the country. They come into Jerusalem and they conquer the city, and they take captives out of Judah and transplant them into other places. Now we have something like that's happened in our history, the Trail of Tears. And so you took Native American people from this part of the country, and they were taken out of their home, out of their native home, and transplanted somewhere else. Well, that might help us to understand the kind of thing that took place in Judah in this would be the late 7th century B.C. There are three invasions, 606, 605 B.C., then 596 and 586, and Daniel was taken captive in that first deportation. He was a young man when he was taken into captivity, very possibly a teenager. And yet, as a teenager, he had already begun to distinguish himself as a very wise man and a young man of tremendously strong character. And we can see that presenting itself in the very first chapter. And so look at verse 2 of chapter 1. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the sanctuary of his God. The king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths, in whom was no defect, who were good looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, who had the ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them literature and language of the Chaldeans. Daniel is in that group. And so he's already distinguished himself as a man of great potential, a young man of great potential, sound physically, sound mentally, just great powers of insight and perception, understanding and wisdom. And so the Babylonians took those Hebrews aside. We're going to train them to work in the king's court. And I'm sure there's a political strategy involved in that. And if we can get some of those Hebrews involved in the king's court, maybe they won't rebel against the king's court. And so the thinking might have been something like that. And so in verse 5 we read that the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank. And he appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Among them, from the sons of Judah, were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Well, as the story unfolds, and many of you may know the story already, Daniel has already made up his mind he is not going to eat the king's food. And so, for 3 years, they're going to be fed a special diet, the king's choice food, and they're going to be trained in Babylonian culture, the language and literature of the Babylonians, and we're going to train these men to work in the king's personal court. And Daniel says, I'm not going to eat the food. And he and his three friends that we call Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they take a stand that they're not going to eat the king's food. And so they come up with an alternative plan. Allow us to eat these vegetables. And after 10 days, take a look at us, examine us, and see how we fare. And of course, they do that. And they fare very well, don't they? They fare very, very well. So that in verse 20 it says, as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And so, if you go back to verse 15, after 10 days, their appearance seemed better, and they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. And so, they take a stand. Here are these young men, maybe teenagers. They take a stand. We're not going to eat the king's food. And of course, the Lord blesses them. And it comes out that they are better than the other men that have been trained. The Lord is with them. And he blesses them with wisdom and insight. And when the king consults them, he finds that they're even better than all the others. And so in the very beginning, we see that Daniel is a man of unusual insight and understanding and wisdom and a very strong character as well. He's able then, as the book unfolds, Daniel is able to serve in the king's court. And this, again, I think this is an unusual character to have. Daniel is able to serve in the king's court without compromising his commitment to God. Now, the book of Daniel opens with the reign of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. But by the end of the book, the Medo-Persian Empire has risen up, and there's Darius the Mede who is in charge. And so Daniel lives outside of Israel for 70 years, for the entire duration of the 70-year captivity. And during that period of time, he's able to serve in the king's court without compromising his commitment to God. Can you imagine that? Serving in government, serving in politics for 70 years and not compromising your commitment to God. And then he's able to do something else I think is remarkable. Both of these together are very remarkable. He's able to serve God while winning the respect of the king. Now that's quite a balancing act, isn't it? Serve in this political realm in government and do it well, do your job very well, and not compromise your commitment to God. And while you're doing that, you're earning the respect of the king all at the same time. And so that just gives us some insight into the really remarkable character of Daniel. In this sermon, we want to look at one episode in Daniel's life taken from Daniel chapter 6. In Daniel chapter 6, we read about, can't see that very well, but Daniel, that's a great picture. That's the best picture I've got on any PowerPoint that I've ever put together. But Daniel in the lion's den. And maybe you can make out, here's Daniel standing over here, and his hands are actually tied behind his back as he's been put into the lion's den. And here are the lions in the lion's den, and they're facing Daniel. They look pretty threatening, but they really haven't jumped on him or attacked him or anything like that. So we're going to look at Daniel in the lion's den. Well, throughout the years, Daniel had proven himself to be a faithful servant of God. Through all this time, Daniel has proven himself. And by the way, Daniel's probably 80 years old or in his 80s by this time. Sometimes you see pictures of Daniel in the lion's den, and it's a young boy in the lion's den. And, well, they need to look at that chronology a little bit closer, because he's in his 80s, I think, at least, when this takes place. And all this time, Daniel has been faithful to God. He's not been compromising his commitment to God. He's been carrying out his service to God as he should. And no doubt that has rubbed some people the wrong way. I'm reminded of the statement in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4. In all this, you know, if you do what's right, in all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them to the same excesses of dissipation, and they malign you. And so I'm quite confident that all this time, Daniel's doing what's right, being faithful, and he's rubbed some people the wrong way, and he's made them, well, they're not very happy with Daniel. He's proven himself to be a reliable official in the government. And when he was about to be promoted in the government, those who were opposed to Daniel, they set out to bring him down. And so let's read a little bit. Daniel chapter 6, verse 1. It seemed good to Darius. Now we shifted empires. And so here's the Medo-Persian Empire. It seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them, and that the king might not suffer loss. And so Daniel is going to have a very high position in the government. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and the satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. And so Daniel he's climbing, isn't he? He's being appointed to a very important position. Well, about that time, those who are opposed to Daniel, they want to bring him down. And so they begin to try to find something out about Daniel that they can use against him. But they couldn't find anything. Look at verse 4. Then the commissioners and the satraps began to trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. That's remarkable, isn't it? Here's a man serving in government all this time. No corruption. No negligence. Did his job. Did it well. Did it faithfully. Did it honestly and honorably. And when these men were going to bring him down, they looked for something that they could use again. They couldn't find a thing. And so, look at verse 5. Then these men said, "We will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God." Well, what a great compliment that is, isn't it? The only thing that we can use against Daniel is his commitment to his God. Would that that could be said of us. But that just shows you the kind of character that Daniel possessed. And so they set out to do that. They lay a trap, and they're set out to spring the trap and catch Daniel in it. These men persuade the king to enact a statute which forbade anyone from making a petition of any kind to any man or any god other than the king himself. For 30 days, nobody can make a petition or make a request or make an appeal to any man or any god, only the king. And so they're sort of counting on the pride of the king, aren't they? And so they persuade him to do that. And so verse 6 says, "These commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction, sign the document so that it may not be changed, according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is the injunction. And so he's persuaded. That sounds like a good idea to me. And that sort of magnifies and emphasizes my importance in the kingdom. And so he signs the document. It becomes law. Four times in the telling of the story, it is emphasized that the law could not be changed. We saw it right here in verse 8. Which may not be revoked. The law may not be revoked once it is signed. And then verse 10. Therefore King Darius signed the document, that is the injunction, that it cannot be revoked. Look at verse 12. Right at the end. The statement is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. And you see it again in verse 15. No injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. And so it's almost as if the writer of the book is just underlying that. It cannot be revoked. It cannot be changed. It cannot be undone once it's signed into law. Well, Daniel's practice, of course, was to pray three times a day. To open his window in his dwelling place, to open his window, face Jerusalem, the holy city where the temple is, where the dwelling place of God is, and pray to God three times a day. Now, you remember the law forbade that. No petitions, no requests made to anyone but the king, no man or God. And those who do something like that could be arrested and executed, thrown into the lion's den. Not beheaded, you know, not a quick death, thrown into the lion's den and torn apart limb from limb. Look at what Daniel's reaction is in verse 10. Now, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he knew it. He knew what had happened. It's very high official. After all, he entered his house, now in his roof chamber, had windows open toward Jerusalem. He continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before God as he had been doing previously. And so he just kept on praying, just like he always had. Their threats didn't change him. He had established a practice. He had made a commitment. And he was going to live up to that commitment, just as he had always done. Now, he could have closed the windows and prayed, and God could have still heard that. He could have closed the windows, gone into his inner chamber and prayed. But what impression would that leave on those who are watching him? It would have left the impression that, well, Daniel is not praying. He must not be praying. You know, we could always see him praying in the window. And now he must have stopped that. And so he didn't want them to think that he had compromised his commitment to God, that he was intimidated by their threats. And so I just leave the window open. And if they see me, they see me. And I'm just willing to suffer the consequences. And in fact, he's discovered. It's reported to the king. He's sentenced to the lion's den. Verse 11. Then these men came by agreement, found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. They approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Didn't you sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? The king replied, the statement is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. I mean, the king understands this can't be revoked. And they answered, and I'm sure with some satisfaction and some degree of glee, they answered and spoke before the king, Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. Now look at the reaction of the king. As soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel, and even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. I mean, it's almost like you go, Oh no, not Daniel. And so he's been put into a corner. He's been manipulated by these men. And he wants to get Daniel off. He tries to figure any way possible to get Daniel out of the situation. But the men remind him, verse 12 or verse 14. As soon as the king heard this statement, he's trying to rescue him, verse 15. Then these men came by agreement to the king, said to the king, "Recognize, O king, it's a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king established can be changed." Now, you remember the law. And these are not nice men, are they? These are evil men. And then Daniel is put into the lion's den. The king hopes that God can save his life. In verse 18, the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." God can do this for you, Daniel. The God that you serve, he can deliver you. And perhaps we remember the rest of the story. A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the signet rings of his nobles so that nothing could be changed in regard to Daniel. The king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. No entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. The king arose at dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. When he come near to the den, to Daniel, Daniel cried out with a troubled voice, or he cried out to Daniel with a troubled voice. And the king spoke and said, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Now, there's wondered what the emotional reaction on the king's part was when he heard Daniel's voice. And Daniel said, "O king, live forever." You know, just had to be. O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths. They have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I've committed no crime. And so the Lord sends his angel and delivers Daniel. Well, of course, his opponents then, the king's, "Okay, I'm going to take care of you guys." He puts them into the lion's den, and the lions tear them limb from limb before they even hit the floor. And so it's not that the lions were not hungry when Daniel was in the lion's den. We see that because of the way they reacted when these enemies of Daniel were put into the lion's den. They're hungry enough. It's just the Lord's doing that Daniel was protected. And in the end, the king praises God. Verse 25. Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, men of every language who are living in all the land, may your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and enduring forever. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. And so here's a confession of faith, a statement of praise to the living God, to Daniel's God. Well, I want to go from there and just talk about some applications and some observations about the story in the time that we have left. The first observation is simply that, as far as the story is concerned, as far as we know, there was only one person, just one, who did not submit to the king's law, and that was Daniel. He was the only one, who did not submit to the king's law. Now, on previous occasions, we read about Daniel's three friends. Remember, in the beginning, in chapter 1, it's Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. They're all together not eating the king's food. And we read about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not bowing to the king's image. But in this story, it's just Daniel. Daniel all alone. And he's targeted by these people. We're going to put a target on Daniel and we're going to attack him and try to do away with him. And so Daniel is the only one who withstood the command. Now, if you know the story of the Bible, you know it's not an isolated case, is it? There have been others who have stood alone. Think about Joseph. Joseph is sold by his brothers into slavery. And then he gets down into Egypt and he's sold into the household of Potiphar. And he works real hard and he gains Potiphar's respect and he's put over the whole household of Potiphar except for his wife. Potiphar's wife tries to seduce him and then lies about him, and Joseph ends up in prison. And while he's in prison, he meets these men, and he, as circumstances turn out, you know, one of them anyway is put back in his position. And Joseph says, how about remembering me when you're put back into your position? But he forgets about him. Have you just thought, I'm sure you have, just thought about how many days Joseph, I'm just saying Daniel, how many days Joseph must have sat in that Egyptian dungeon by himself, all alone, betrayed by his brothers, lied about, forgotten. He's all alone. He's the only one in that kind of situation. And yet, he doesn't compromise his commitment. He doesn't lose his faith. He doesn't say, well, maybe if I adapted my lifestyle to the Egyptian culture, maybe these bad things would stop happening to me. No, he's the only one in the whole place that takes this stand, and he's consistent with it. And in the end, of course, the Lord blesses him. That's Genesis chapter 37 and following, by the way, if you'd like to read the story of Joseph. How about the situation or the case of Esther? In the story of Esther, Esther is a Jewish woman, and through a series of events, she becomes queen. And of course, God is superintending these events, and he's directing these events so that Esther becomes the queen. Well, there's a threat made against the Jewish race, all the Jews throughout the empire. Their life is being threatened. And so Mordecai, the cousin of Esther, persuades her because she's become queen. Persuades her, talks to her about going in and making an appeal to the king. And she says, you know, can't do that. You can't just waltz in to the king's room and start making demands. And that's just not the way things are done. In fact, if you take the chance and go in there and he hasn't invited you, he can kill you. He can do away with you if he wants to. And he hasn't called me in a long time. They continue to talk, and Mordecai says, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. It may be that God has put you in this place at this time for exactly this purpose. And so she says to Mordecai, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa. Fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I'm the maidens. My maidens also will fast in the same way. And thus I'll go into the king, which is not according to the law. And if I perish, I perish. Okay, I'll go. She's in a unique position. She's the only one that's in that position. And so, but she decides, it's dangerous for her, but she decides, okay, I'll go. It's the way I've got it envisioned in my mind. And she's getting ready. She puts on her royal robes and all that. And she gets ready to go to the king. And there may be people there helping her. She has some maids that attend to her, no doubt. But she's got to make that walk alone at some point, doesn't she? And she's got to walk in to approach the king's quarters by herself. It's not a delegation that goes. It's not a committee that goes. It's not a council that goes. It's one woman that goes. One. All by herself. And she goes into the king, and the king accepts her and listens to her. You see this idea of standing alone? It's not an isolated case with Daniel. See it with Joseph. See it with Esther. One of the ones that appeals to me is found in 1 Kings chapter 22. In this particular place, Jehoshaphat is king of Judah, and Ahab, who is king of Israel, appeals to Jehoshaphat to go with him to fight the Syrians. And Jehoshaphat agrees. Okay, he says in verse 5, or a little bit earlier than that, you know, okay, I'll agree. And verse 4, I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. But Jehoshaphat says, well, please inquire first for the word of the Lord. Is there a prophet that we could call in who would tell us the word of the Lord about this? Us fighting together and joining forces and going and fighting the Syrians. And you remember Ahab said, well, there's one. I don't like him very much. He never has anything good to say about me. And so that's verse 8. There's yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, because he doesn't prophesy good concerning me, but evil. He is Micaiah, the son of Imlah. But Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. Let's call him in. And so send a messenger to go get Micaiah and bring him to where the king is so that Micaiah can give them the word of the Lord. Look at verse 13. The messenger who went to summon Micaiah spoke to him saying, behold now, the words of the prophets are uniformly favorable to the king. Please let your word be like one of them and speak favorably. Look, Micaiah, can't you just one time? Can't you just once say, get along and do what everybody else says? Say the same thing that everybody else is saying. Do you always have to be different? Micaiah says, I can only say what the Lord tells me to say. And eventually, as the story unfolds, Micaiah tells him that disaster awaits. If you go into battle, disaster is waiting. And of course, Ahab is killed in battle. And for that message, Micaiah is put into prison. As far as the story is concerned, I don't believe we read about him getting out of prison. And so he's put into prison. Again, the idea, I'm all by myself. I'm standing alone. I'm the only one. Well, we see that multiple times in the story of the Bible. Where did Daniel find the strength to continue to pray as he had done before? Where did he find the strength to do that? Where did he get enough strength to be the only one to do this? Well, if you look at Daniel chapter 6 and verse 23, right at the end it says it was because he had trusted in his God. That gave him the strength, the courage, the wherewithal to stand even though he was standing alone. He was less concerned about what others thought of him and more concerned about doing right. And the same is true of the others that we've talked about, Joseph and Esther and Ahab. So our first observation is this, that we may have to stand. I'm going to come back to that. That's not our first observation. Our first observation is that there are times we may be the only one to stand. Do you ever think you're the only one trying to do what's right at work? You ever look at the people around you and think, you know, these people are worldly people. They have no interest in doing right. It seems like I'm the only one. I'm the only one that wants to live the right kind of life. How about if you're in school? Do you ever feel that way at school? All these other students around me, I hear the way they talk. I hear the language that they use. I hear what they talk about. I know what they're doing on the weekends. It just seems like I'm the only one trying to do what's right. Have you ever had this conversation with your daughter? But Dad, I'm the only one that can't wear that. I'm the only one. Everybody is wearing this. Everybody is. Why do I have to be the only one who can't wear that? Or, Dad, all my friends are going to the party. I'm the only one that can't go. Why do I have to be different all the time? Or, what do you mean I can't go to the dance? All my friends are going to the dance. I can't go. I'm the only one who can't go. Well, just remember in that situation that Daniel was the only one. Joseph was the only one. Esther had to stand alone. Micaiah had to stand alone. God's people sometimes have to stand alone. And yet, this point is that we're not really alone when we have to take that stand. We're not the only one who's trying to serve God faithfully. Do you remember Elijah's story? You might have already thought about Elijah's story in connection with these comments. But in 1 Kings chapter 19, after Elijah has defeated the prophets of Baal, he's threatened by Jezebel. Remember, he flees. He's discouraged. And about the situation, he flees out into the wilderness. And the Lord appeals to him. What are you doing here, Elijah? Verse 10. I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. And I alone am left. And they seek my life. I'm the only one that's taking this stand. And then they're after me now. Do you remember what Daniel is told in verse 14? As you go through the passage, I have 7,000, the Lord says in verse 18. I have 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Elijah, you may think that you're alone, but you're not alone. There are others out here, and they're trying to do what's right. Now, you know, I might know them, you might not know their names or where they are, but I assure you there are others who are in the same struggle that you're in. And so you're not alone. If you're at work and you're the only one, feel like the only one, or you're in school and you feel like you're the only one, or in your family you're the only one. No, there are others among God's people who are trying to do what's right. They're just like you. And they can help you. You know, it's important that we stay in touch with each other. And one of the ways we stay in touch is by worshiping together. But it's important that we stay in touch with each other, that we encourage each other. Boy, I tell you, it's discouraging to be on that island by yourself, isn't it? And you're the only one trying to do what's right. You know, there are a lot of faults with social media. You know, there's a lot of reasons to be critical of social media. But here's a good thing with social media. Young people can stay in touch with each other. Young Christians can stay in touch with each other. And we can talk to each other and we can be encouraged and we can encourage others as a result of Facebook and Instagram and all those kinds of things. And so here's a tool that we can use. And again, it's easy to criticize that. And I've done my share of it. But this is a good tool if it's used properly. And it'll help us to understand that we are not alone. The Bible tells us evil companions corrupt good morals. But in like manner, godly companions strengthen good morals. Proverbs 13, verse 20, he who walks with wise men will be wise. And so if you can communicate, stay in touch with wise people, godly people, that can encourage you and you can encourage them. And so it may feel like you're alone, but you're not alone. There are others out there who are struggling just like you are. You can be encouraged by them and you can encourage them. But even if we were alone, you still need to do what's right. Still needs to serve God faithfully nonetheless. You ever notice that a person's character is not revealed in what he does when he's in the company of others? I suppose it is to some degree. But his true character is in what he does when he's alone. What do you do when you're alone? Now, if you're in the company of others, they might influence your behavior. What do you do when you're all by yourself? That's when we really find out what our character is, or when we're standing alone. We know what kind of man Daniel was because he stood alone without compromise. He stood strong. He stood firm. We knew what kind of man Joseph was because he stood alone. He had every reason, every excuse to not stand alone. You know, when Potiphar's wife comes, man, I'm not in Israel. My family doesn't know anything about this. She's not going to tell anybody. Okay, well, let's go. He doesn't do it, does he? We know what kind of man Joseph is because when he was alone, we see his character, see his actions. Esther, Micaiah, and others as well. And so, we need to do right even if we are alone. If this happens, we know that the Lord is with us. And so not only are there others out there in the same struggle and trying to do what's right that can encourage us and we can encourage them, but we also need to know that even if we are alone and no other human being is around to give us that encouragement, that the Lord is with us and He can encourage us. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 4. Here's right at the end of Paul's last letter before he loses his life. In verse 16, he says, in my first defense, no one supported me. Okay, I'm all alone. No one supported me. All deserted me. May it not be counted against them. But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me so that through me the proclamation might be fully accomplished and that all the Gentiles might hear. And I was rescued out of the lion's mouth. I was deserted, nobody there to hold up my hands and to encourage me. When I looked out in the crowd, I didn't see a smiling face out there, a supportive face. But the Lord was with me, and He strengthened me. And so we need to know that. We need to know that if I'm the only one in my school that's trying to do what's right, I'm not really alone. The Lord is with me. And if I'm the only one at work trying to do what's right, I'm not really alone. the Lord is with me, and He'll strengthen me. Proverbs 15, verse 3 says, the eyes of the Lord are in every place, keeping watch on the evil and the good. That can be a threatening thing, but that can be an encouraging thing as well. The eyes of the Lord are watching you, and He's seeing the good that you do. And He approves of that, and He is not going to let that go unrewarded, is He? And so know that the Lord is with you. One of the great promises of the Bible, isn't it? Do not be afraid. I am with you. Do not be afraid. I am with you. True greatness is not found in those who follow the masses. Back that up a little bit. Okay, here we go. True greatness is achieved when we stand apart from the crowd. True greatness is not found in those who follow the masses, but in those who are willing, those who are courageous enough, or stubborn enough, or determined enough, or committed enough to follow a different path. That's really the definition of greatness, isn't it? We're different from the rest. We stand apart from the masses. We don't follow the crowd. We blaze a new trail, so to speak. And that's where true greatness is found. Did you know there's no hall of fame for average? Did you know that? Now, there's a hall of fame for the exceptional. The Babe Ruths, the Lou Gehrigs of the sport. But there's no hall of fame for the average. Did you know, I found this out, there is no C honor roll. I wish there had been a C honor roll. There's no C honor roll. The honor roll is for the exceptional, the achiever, the one who distinguishes himself or herself from the average. No one is given an award for being just like everybody else. Congratulations, you've achieved great mediums of mediocrity. Here's your beige ribbon. You know? That doesn't happen, does it? That true greatness is not found in the crowd. True greatness is found among those who are willing to go against the crowd, apart from the crowd. Now, of course, greatness in the judgment of the Lord is based on different things than greatness among men. We need to make that point. It's based on humility and service and self-denial. But again, greatness by definition requires something different and extraordinary. And we want to be great in the eyes of the Lord. It's not going to be found in the crowd. It's going to be found if we're willing to stand apart from the crowd. Remember Luke chapter 1, as John the Baptist's father is being told about the son that his wife would have. And he says in verse 13, do not be afraid, Zacharias. Your petition has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear your son. You'll give him the name John. You'll have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. He will be great in the sight of the Lord. He'll drink no wine or liquor. He'll be filled with the Holy Spirit while yet in his mother's womb, and he will turn many of the sons of Israel back to the Lord their God. It is he who will go as a forerunner before him in the spirit and power of Elijah. He will be great in the eyes of the Lord. And here are the things that he's going to do that distinguish him from the crowd. The scriptures tell us to excel, to grow, to press on. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 1 says, excel still more. Don't be satisfied with average. Don't be satisfied with what everybody else does. Don't be satisfied. I just want to be one of the crowd. Excel. Excel still more in everything you do, but especially in spiritual things. Grow. Press on. Excel. And be great. Great in the eyes of the Lord. Now, the world might not appreciate that, but great in the eyes of the Lord. And then our last observation is this, that the example of one doing right may influence others in a powerful way. Daniel had already had a good influence on the king. We can see that from his reaction when he realized his decree would result in Daniel's death. We talked about that a little bit as we went through the story. Once they said, well, you know, Daniel, you know, one of the refugees from Judah, you know, he's been praying to his God. You remember that? Oh, no, I didn't think about Daniel. Was the king's reaction. And so Daniel has already made an impact, an impression on the king. We see it in his comments to Daniel in verse 16. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God whom you constantly serve will himself deliver you. We see him, his words the following day in verses 20 and 21. When the king came near to the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, servant of the living God, is your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you? And so where did the king learn all that? And then, of course, we see his words at the end of the episode. Where did he learn about Daniel's God? Well, the Babylonians might have learned something about the God of Israel just in their interaction with him. But is there any doubt that he had learned about Daniel's God from Daniel himself and watching Daniel and watching the way he lived his life and the way he carried out his life and the things that Daniel said? No doubt that's where he learned about Daniel's God, by Daniel's example. And here is the king. And we saw the statement he made at the end of the episode about God. His kingdom, it will endure forever. He's a living God that will endure forever. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. There's the power of one. The power of one example. One faithful person in the midst of others. Now, not everybody's going to react that way, of course. Daniel's opponents didn't act that way. They were not that impressed with Daniel and his God. And so, don't have the idea that, well, if I stand for what's right, everybody's just going to be influenced by that for good. Not everybody. But perhaps one will. And so, let your light shine. Matthew 6, verse 16. Let your light shine so that others may see your good works and be drawn to the Father. And remember, that's what I told my children growing up, remember, your light shines the brightest when it's dark. And so you may be in a dark place at work, spiritually speaking. You may be in a dark place in your school. You may be in a dark place among your family members. Let that light shine. And let it shine brightly. And perhaps the influence of one will have a tremendous impact on others. Well, Daniel was a great man, wasn't he? His greatness was recognized by others. It was recognized by even non-Israelites. And few will have the impact that Daniel has had. But you can be a Daniel in your own place and in your own circle of influence, can't you? You can be a Daniel among your friends. You can be a Daniel in your school. You can be a Daniel at work or Daniel in your family, even if it means acting alone. You can be a Daniel. And the Lord will see that. And the Lord will recompense. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, we want to give you an opportunity to respond to the invitation. Put your faith in Jesus Christ, repent of your sins, confess your faith, and be baptized. It may be that you'll be the only one in your family to do that. And they may not be happy when you go home and tell them. But you've got support here. You're not the only one to do that. You're not the only one trying to do what's right. And you'll have support from others. And you'll have encouragement, and you'll be able to encourage them. And so don't let that stop you. If you're ready to make that commitment, make it. We can help you with that tonight. If you're already a Christian, but it may be that you felt the pressure of being alone, well, take a stand. Make the necessary corrections and take that stand. And the Lord will see, and He'll take note, and He'll reward you for it. And so whatever you need to do tonight to be right with God, we invite you to do it. If we can help you, we invite you to come.